So when it comes to laying the foundation for a great team culture, where do you start? Like, what's this process for the very best teams in the world? In the next two episodes of the podcast, we're very fortunate to have USA Women's Field Hockey Coach, Coach Dave Passmore, on the podcast sharing with us the story of how he has approached this since taking over the team in early 2023. Now, when Dave took over the team was underperforming, not qualifying for the last Olympics or even the World Cup. But just a few months ago, they did what few thought was possible. They qualified for the Olympics against great odds in the Olympic qualifiers in India. Now, just a little bit about Dave Passmore. He was formerly a professor of coaching science and education at DCU, Dublin City University in Ireland. He has applied the practical knowledge that he has gained as a teacher, coach, coach developer, and high performance director to various sporting contexts, businesses, and academic areas of research. He worked with British hockey before he moved to Ireland, where he coached the Irish men's team and served as high performance director with Hockey Ireland for 7 years. Then Dave spent another 10 years in academia, where his key research interests were culture building, coach development, and talent development, as well as applying science and data within the coaching process. He's been to two Olympics as the former Ireland's men's head field hockey coach and the women's national assistant coach. And I've been very fortunate to have supported him through one-on-one coaching for over a year now at this stage. In today's episode, he's going to tell us not just the story of this turnaround for the team and for the program, but how he laid the foundation for the culture that exists at USA Women's Field Hockey today. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, the podcast to help you grow as a leader and build a better culture. My name is JP Nurbin, and I'm joined by my friends and co-hosts, Nate Sanderson and Betsy Butterick. Actually, Betsy actually sat this interview out. But in addition to this podcast, I'm the founder of TOC, which supports leaders and their teams to build extraordinary cultures through one-on-one coaching, consulting, online training, and speaking. Learn more about all that at tocculture.com, as well as subscribe to our newsletter to get the notes to this episode of the podcast and every episode of the podcast, as well as our top 10 articles and podcast episodes. All right, Dave, I'm so glad we got to make this podcast happen, as you are very busy heading into the Olympics, man. But I just want to start off our conversation today, giving our listeners a little bit of background on your history and coaching and how a man comes from England to Ireland and all the way over to become the head women's hockey coach of the USA International Olympic team. So tell us a little bit about that journey.
Well, I've done a bit of what you've done in reverse. So I'm in South Carolina at the moment, in Hilton Head. Played field hockey as a kid, injured when I was at college. So I started coaching really young, went into teaching. And there's obviously a real clear affinity between teaching and coaching. Was fortunate to coach some good teams and got success. Not I coach good teams. I was fortunate to have good players and I got lucky. I went into international coaching quite young, in my late 20s. And I worked 14 years with England and Great Britain for 7 years. And then I went to Ireland and coached their men's team. So I've coached at Olympics. I've coached men, women, girls, boys, every age group. I was performance director in Ireland, but something I realized was that I only coached based on what I thought. So I went back before masters became a real thing and did a sports coaching masters through Loughborough. And then I went on to do a doctorate in coach development. And then when I finished I was kind of burnt out after 14 years of full-time elite sport. I did 10 years as a university professor in sports science. I was head of the sports science and health degree in Dublin City University. So we'd moved across to Ireland for the job and for the family reasons. And I spent 10 years there where I really actually learned and understood coaching far more than I ever did. I never called myself an academic. I called myself a pracademic. That it was also always about taking the academic and how does that look practically? And I struggled with that concept in the sense of, you had all these academics, but they couldn't actually talk in a language that you could understand or to actually educate. So I started coaching again. I got the bug back. I got my energy back, club assistant coach with Ireland, who are pretty successful with the women's team. And I coached their under 21 team for 5 years, the indoor team. And then I realized that I'd never really achieved what I wanted to achieve in coaching as a senior coach, really because I wasn't prepared. I went in so young, I'd never had a really good grounding. And it was when coaching was very different from how it is now. It was very amateur, it was very autocratic, didactic. So I kind of had unfinished business, I suppose, is how I describe it. But I wasn't going to go back unless I saw an opportunity which came that I felt I could make a real difference. And the USA had been underachieving for 3 or 4 years. They'd had some glory years in the past. They centralized for a period in Pennsylvania, which is where most of the players are from. So this opportunity came up, didn't know that I'd stand a chance. Thankfully landed the job. And what I arrived into was very different from what I thought I was arriving into. And I think somebody who'd just been just a coach, a really good on-field coach, would have really struggled with the role because it was a much bigger role than I'd expected. So that brought me to the USA. We're now based in North Carolina in Charlotte, which is a great location. We didn't have our own field. We had no facilities. And through the support of the USPC, we now have facilities. But all that was part of my role as coach. And I arrived and I was the only person. So it was very different from what I'd expected. So hopefully I'm building something now. But I certainly didn't expect after the first 6 months in the job that we'd be able to qualify for the Paris Olympics. And really my contract was only to then. So I was under a bit of pressure. And I knew that from the start. So the biggest and most important thing that I did was build a culture. And really that culture, more than our hockey, has got us to where we are now, which is obviously going to Paris, which we hadn't achieved. We haven't been to an Olympics for 12 years.
Yeah. And before we start to unpack that culture thing, which is, you know, probably one of our next questions there, I just have to ask, you look at the whole experience that you've had in coaching from when you started going and studying coaching and coach development and getting a doctorate and teaching at the university level around coaching, right? All these experiences, what's been the most important? If you just had to say, and I know they've all been important, but what has been the most unique, impactful thing that has helped prepare you to do what you're doing today at USA Field Hockey?
Is it probably my mistakes? Learning, being super reflective and acknowledging that things that I've done in the past weren't right, and the bravery to sort of almost admit that to myself, admit that to people around me, and then be able to go and do it. That's probably the first thing. And then I think the second thing is the thing that I probably do most now is invest in people. The time I spend meeting with people week on week is more time than I spend on a field coaching them or working with them as staff. They're probably the two biggest things. And that's also the bit I love. I've worked at junior level, and that feeling that you can help people self-actualize and reach their potential I really enjoy. And then in our environment, I don't think it's about just about the team or the individual. It's as a field hockey player, an athlete, it's about making them and us better as people and growing in what we do day by day that I really enjoy. And I never really valued the importance about that. It was all just about what we did on the field.
Dave, I'm curious about this. I think, you know, the coaches that listen to our podcast, you know, especially this time of year, we're kind of in that coaching hiring cycle. And when we think about the potential to level up, you know, whether it's going from an amateur to a professional level, or in your case, you know, going obviously all the way to the Olympic level, were there any fears that you had to overcome or doubts about just your own confidence when you took this job that that was part of the adjustment for you?
I think that's a really good question. And as I said, I arrived on my own. I was the only coach here. I had nobody else. So the fear I had was, could I do everything that I needed to do? One of my biggest weaknesses is trying to do everything. So looking at what the team needed and bringing in a coach that could give what they needed and handing over a lot of responsibility in that area can be quite tough, because as the word is coach, and yet on-field coaching is, for me, is a very small part of the role. So that's probably the biggest fear that I had, was bringing somebody in, finding that right person. And I do believe I found the right person. I've got an amazing assistant coach in Javier Telechea. I've just brought another coach on board, an Olympic gold medalist herself, Maddie Hinch. And she's giving us something extra, that she's won a gold at an Olympic Games. And we don't have one player athlete that's even been to an Olympic Games. So what she can bring. And, you know, I think that's the biggest fear, is when you're considered the head coach, is delegation and doing what's right for the team and not it not being around you. And I probably wasn't like that when I first started coaching, and I was coached and taught by a lot of people like that. If we won a game, it was the coach that did it, you know. And I've become more accepting now that it's very much all about the team and the athletes.
Yeah, let me ask you one more follow-up to that, because I think, you know, again, when we're building a staff, I don't care if it's at the middle school level, the high school level, the professional level, and you're thinking about delegation, which is obviously important, and unity as a staff is important, but there has to be a foundation of trust there, you know. And when you're coming in by yourself without bringing in a group with you, how does that trust get established when you first bring that first person on board on your staff?
A very good friend of mine always said to me, if you give love, you get love. So I think giving trust was the most important thing. And I inherited a management team, some of whom have been here for 2 or 3 years, who were very close to the previous coach and former regimes. And I said that to them, for the start, I'm going to trust you until you give me a reason not to. And it's the most important thing to me. And that message would be the same whether I was in a professional program or I was working with a group of kids, because any group of athletes, no matter what age they are, will see, and sometimes parents, supporters, and athletes themselves will expose those weaknesses or cracks. And, you know, that the staff group that we have has evolved, and we've just taken a really hard look at ourselves and our culture, and did it align with the team culture. And I think through being honest and saying, I didn't get this right, I got this wrong, I should have done this myself, creates the environment where they can do the same. But on the same thing, I always talk about trust as being the most important thing. So I brought in somebody I believed I could trust, and I've never been shown otherwise. I got that bit right. And sometimes you don't do that right, and you have to acknowledge it. And the way I would always do things, like, we just brought Maddie in, she's on a temporary contract. And part of the reason is, it allows me to know, is she the right person? And I know already, within a week of working with her, that she's very much the right person. But that is so important, is, you know, if you're, you know, to delegate. And then it's about having honest conversations if there's a lack of trust. And that can be sometimes be the hardest thing. You don't have to be the best coaching team in the world, or the best management team, if you're honest, reflective, and unified. Mm-hmm. And that means challenging each other and not fear being challenged. And my assistant coach challenges me more than anyone. And at times it's quite overwhelming how much he challenges me. He'll challenge me about things that the day before he said black, I say black, he then says white. And that for me is healthy. And if I don't feel we're being self-honest, I will throw a spanner in the works and say something. I think we should select this athlete to see will people stand up and give their view or perspective, so that I know that they feel that they've got a voice and that they, you know, that they feel I'd listen to them and trust them.
There's a few things that you've said over the last 5-10 minutes here that I want to pull out so that the listeners really understand, A, that it's true and what it really looks like. One is I've spent time outside of our, you know, weekly calls together. I've gotten to spend time around you and the team and you and your staff. And there definitely is a lot of challenge. And I love what you said there. It's difficult for you. It's frustrating for you at times to be challenged that much, but you're able to self-correct and, you know, get yourself in the right place of, no, you understand this is the healthy culture that I'm trying to build. And I think a lot of times coaches are frustrated. We want to have open dialogue, but the second we get challenged and we have this response of like, oh, is, you know, we make it about ourselves and we're not able to let go of that. And I think you do a really beautiful job of that. There's something else that you also shared earlier when you were talking about just even the things that you learned along that experience and just how you're more about people than ever. When I've observed you coaching the team, it's very many times untraditional of what people would think a head coach should be doing. In practices, you didn't run the majority of drills. In fact, I saw you coach very few drills in my few days there. You've empowered your people. You're there, you're present, you're having conversations. In the games, you have your assistant coach right next to the players. He's doing the communication and timeouts. You're up in the box. You have to trust him by communicating what you're seeing, and he gets to, you know, I think so often in coaching, especially I think maybe in American coaching, we want to be the one that's on the sideline and all the attention's on us. And you've put that, you've given that trust to Javi out there. And just to also reiterate, you know, about people, the amount of time you spend on one-on-ones and you know, I got coaches say, I don't have time for that. And you have a huge panel. You haven't even selected down to your final team that you're going to take to Paris. And yet you are constantly making time for your athletes. That's one of your priorities. It's just, I feel like you probably spend half your time in one-on-ones with your staff and your players. It's incredible. So I'll stop there, but those are some things that I've observed that I feel like I needed to share with listeners.
Yeah. I think just coming back to the bit where I go upstairs and the athletes still know I make the final decisions on selection and that every practice is set up by me, but what it allows me to do is step back and really watch and drive the standards. And that's where I see the biggest need for me is around the standards of which we're doing things, not necessarily the detail, but then I need to be able to step back and watch and be able to feedback to every athlete every week. We now have a 3-hour open door on a Wednesday morning where athletes can come in and then, you know, to start with, it was a trickle, and now like it's gone from 1.5 hours to 3 hours, because sometimes it's just about connecting. And there were a couple of athletes in the team, which when I sat down and did reviews with, we just admitted we didn't have a connection. You can't connect easily with every athlete in the team. So now I deliberately connect with those people and they come in and meet me once every week so that we have time together. You can't really, unless we know what's going on in people's lives, we can't affect what's going on the field. And often what I've worked at outside of the field will have the biggest impact on them on the field. And the questions I ask them are probably the most important things in some of those conversations. I'm not a shouting, demanding coach. High performance is a choice. And if you don't step up, then you don't get selected. And that was one of the other biggest learning points, is that the behaviors of athletes are more important sometimes than, you know, their technique or skill. Because over time that will always out. And it's taken some of our younger athletes a long time to realize that.
So let's start from the beginning here. You take this job for USA Field Hockey. As you mentioned earlier, they were underachieving the last few years prior to you taking over as head coach. You know, your role has been multifaceted, from, you know, helping to set things up so that, as you said, it's a centralized team. For our listeners, that means that the majority of the athletes that will be competing live within the area and are training year round with you all. So when you take over this program, what's step one for you, you know, and building this culture?
Well, I inherited a squad of 37 athletes, and I couldn't understand the reason why it was so big, but I very much can now. That's all around NCAA rules. So if an athlete's in a national team, they can train extra. When there are periods when the college athletes can only train 4 hours, ours can train extra. But the first thing I did was I met each and every one of them. One of those meetings lasted 5 hours. And that kid, amazingly, when we defined our culture, stepped away. And since then, she started coaching and came back to me and said, I always felt you were picking on me, but now I realize you were just trying to get the best out of me. And that's, I only understand that now I do coaching. So I arrived in Charlotte. There were 9 athletes at my first training session. 6 of them were outfield, 3 goalies. Have you ever coached a team where, you know, you've only had 1 goalie in a game and yet you've got 3 and only the double amount of athletes? So that in itself was a challenge, but I met them to get to know each and every one of them. We had athletes in Europe playing, athletes in Australia playing, athletes at college. So that was a lot of investment in them. But the most important thing that I got out of those meetings was obviously getting to know them. What's the one thing that I need to do that was going to make the biggest impact on this team? And very clearly out of that, they said, we don't understand high performance. And some of them verbalize it. We don't have a defined team culture. So whilst I could see that and feel it, what was more important is that they knew it and understood. And you don't know what you don't know. So they didn't know the levels at which we needed to train at, the standards we needed to set. And I didn't have any role models in there, in a sense of, if we want to go to an Olympic Games, what does that really take? And then the really difficult thing for me, the biggest challenge I found, was I had to spend 3 months before the whole group together. So whilst I knew I had to have a clearly defined culture and set these standards, there was no point doing it with 9 people. And then there were 12 because there was 3 injuries. The other 2/3 then arrive and go, we've not been a part of this culture. What's this all about? I don't relate to this. This isn't my culture. So I had to wait. Now, there was kind of a positive and a negative in that. The positive was that I could actually understand US national culture. I could understand the culture of field hockey in the US, what they valued as important and not important. Very different from UK, Ireland. And I had to buy into that. And then secondly, I could also start to influence who I felt could build the culture and what I felt was important through our discussions and conversations, if that makes sense. So when I arrived, there'd been a real pushback on the amount the team had trained, and it was all about balance. But what I saw was the attempt to find balance was they weren't training enough and we were never going to qualify for the Olympics. And I had to have conversations that then I handed it to them. They had a choice, and we formed a leadership group. There was an existing leadership group, a captain's group, and my influence of those people and my discussions with those people around what I found important, they found important, and finding shared areas was a benefit that we didn't just go straight into building a culture. So then we had a full training camp in Chula Vista where we had the whole group there for 12 days. We have an excellent sports psychologist who joined us for 5 days. And really, I just shared my vision with her of what I wanted. I'm around the sort of Edgar Schein kind of 3 levels of culture: artifacts, clear, defined behaviors, and then they become inherent. And I think we're probably still somewhere between 2 and 3, i.e. we have clearly written behaviors but they're not inherent in everything we do. Some bits are now, but not enough. And that's going to take time. So we before we got to the camp, we established five cultures, five values. And then we spent 5 days looking at each value, five sessions. So it wasn't rushed. And building into that, we built like a name for the team, and a hashtag is Flyers One, United Eagles. So I can show you here. This is, it was about building the artifacts. This is my phone. So you can see, and Flyers One, and then our five values, they were the top five values that came out from the team. And then we picked each of the sort of main environments. So in training, in lift, and then lifestyle general, when they're not with the team. Because I think culture, you know, we train 4 hours a day, 5 days a week, 20 hours, so it's 168 hours in a week. So 148 hours is the most important part of your team culture, not just the 20 hours they're with you. So we took each value and said, well, what does this look like in this environment, and this environment? And that's how the culture built. And then we built a document from it, from those sessions. Psychologists led it, athletes fed in, and then working with the leadership group, we just refined it down to what those conscious behaviors that we then had to drive. And that doesn't happen overnight, and it's still happening. So we had to keep revisiting them. We got them to grade themselves. We said, well, if an opposition coach came in today, what would they see? What would be the strengths in terms of our behaviors, the weaknesses? If a drone flew over training today, what would they see in those values? And really, because we didn't have people who'd been to the Olympics and knew what it took, there had to be a level of education around our leadership group as well. And they knew that, and they were open to that, and they wanted to learn and develop. So I spent a lot of time, as you when you came in, you spent time with them, JP, willingness to drive that culture. But what I want to say is we qualified for the Olympics because of our culture, not so much because of our hockey, because I think our hockey was below the level of some of the other teams going in, but our culture allowed it to stand out. If I give you some examples of that, one of our values is selfless. So when we selected our squad, we still had numerous athletes that weren't selected, but still had to train and had to push the others to become the best versions of themselves. And some of those athletes started to perform better than the athletes we'd selected at that time. For whatever reason, maybe some dropped off because they were selected. A few of them that weren't selected stepped up, pressure was off. So that you know, and then even when we go to tournament, we brought an athlete away that had to be there, and she was a reserve, but only until the point the team was submitted. So I want to name her, Linnea Gonzalez. She came away. She had to stay in India knowing she was never going to play and be part of the team. And that's where selfless sits in. So, you know, there's clear examples of selflessness. And then we were relentless in terms of our preparation, relentless being our second value. And so we knew every opposition unbelievably well. And then we had the real discipline, third thing, that we knew our game plan, and the game plan was bought into, understood by every single member of the team. And I've never seen a team work as hard and diligently about understanding their individual roles. And nor have I ever had a team that's gone 3.5 matches in a major tournament without conceding a goal. And that requires implementation of discipline to the structures, the defensive structures that we had. But there's probably a real key point, because our fourth value is joy. The way I wanted them to feel, and our psychologist was very much a part of this, and the team started to realize, they thought going into a game, they had to be pumped and they had to be ready and fired up. But hockey is a game where you make decisions. You haven't got, it's not such a physical battle like American football, like football or rugby, which would be one of my key sports. So we finished our preparation 6 or 7 hours, and then it was about relaxing and enjoying yourself. And that was dancing on the field. It was playing Keepy Uppy. It was fun in the changing room. And that joy of just being together unified allowed us to perform, because it took away some of the pressure away from us. And it allowed us to implement the discipline and relentlessness that we had. The final value that we have is about respect of ourselves and our teammates. And that what that does is that makes me look at you and say, well, have you done everything you've done? Because I have. My lifestyle has been spot on. It's about respect of our opponents. And I remember when we won our pool, we knocked out New Zealand, who are ranked 7 places above us in the world. They've never not qualified for Olympics since 1980s, and they had a lot of really decorated, seasoned internationals that were probably never going to grace a hockey field again. And as delighted as we were, we had 2 games to qualify for the Olympics. We talked about respecting them, because we had to sit and eat in the same dining room as them an hour later. And there's a fantastic photo of one of our athletes consoling one of their athletes who was in pieces. That now they've been former teammates, but that is, for me, respect at the highest level. When I look at how we performed in that tournament, it was the commitment to our culture as well as the hockey background. You can do all the hockey all you like, all the preparation, but if you didn't commit to that culture, and that's when I started to see behaviors go from conscious to unconscious. People started to do things because that's what you do. And now I've started to see people who come into our team environment who adopt those behaviors without consciously thinking, I have to do this. And that's what Edgar Schein talks about in his third level of culture.
Dave, there's a lot there to unpack. I want to go all the way back to the beginning just for a second, and then I'm sure JP will jump in here after that. You take over this program and you come in and you don't know a lot of the players. You don't have the whole team together. You're trying to establish a culture that has player input. You're trying to understand the perspective of the players. And you also have this vision for the program of there's a whole nother level that we have to get to here if we're going to compete to qualify for the Olympics. I think a lot of times when coaches walk into a situation like that, sometimes we feel the burden of that vision has to come from me, right? But we know that it's got to be something that there's collaboration. And so my question for you is, in your role as the coach, again, it kind of goes back to this issue of trust. These new players that are just getting to know you for the first time, they have to buy in with something, right? In order for them to even participate in that process and feel like that their input is valued. How do you have to show up as the new guy, as the head coach, in order to start to build that rapport and that trust and ultimately that collaboration to make this culture possible?
What you want is for them to feel that they can be authentic and honest with you. So you have to be authentic and honest with them. And what I've learned over the years is if you are that, you tell them about things you're struggling with, then they can tell you there's things they're struggling with. How you react to them saying that is really super important. That said, what we had to go back to is, well, what do we really want to achieve? And really, the key thing that happened was we had a very open dialogue. We had a big leadership group. It was too big at the time. We had 8 of them. We had a performance director who was a former Olympic coach and coach of the team when they were most recently at their best. And I brought in a German coach who just won 2 World Cups, one as the head coach of the Dutch women and the other as assistant coach of the German men. And it was a question that I asked, what do you really want to achieve? Do you think that what we're currently doing and where we're currently at is enough to achieve that? And they threw that at the other people in that meeting. The German, absolutely not. The German went, I'm looking at what my men are doing at the moment. You're doing this number of hours. They're doing, I think we were doing like 9 hours on a field, maybe 10. They're doing, and you're doing 4 hours in the gym, 14 hours. They're doing 21, 22, and you're already behind. And I left that with them, with the leadership group. And they also asked me, what would an ideal program be? So if I had them full, because they all have to work, we don't fund them fully. So most of them work afternoons. They asked me, what did it look like? Ironically, they came back with a schedule that was bigger than mine, that was almost too much, because they made the decision themselves that they wanted to go to the Olympics. But it was only through us showing them that we're not going to achieve what we want to achieve. So if you don't have that goal, you can't make the hard decisions, but you have to make those decisions together. And yes, we lost people on the way. I spoke about the athlete earlier who I spent 5 hours with, who decided after the culture meetings it wasn't for her, it was too hard. And that's a choice. High performance is a choice. And the group made a choice. And when we did qualify, the first thing that I said in the huddle was I went back to that meeting and I reminded the whole group that their leadership group had made a decision on their behalf that we were going to up what we were going to do. 7 athletes had come out of their college degree for a year to commit to that, and that had been worthwhile.
Mm.
And yeah, we wouldn't have done it without them making that decision. So I think that trust then is I don't sit there and take all the credit, because the credit isn't all mine. What I've done is facilitated a process. And I'm not saying that's easy, but asking the right questions is probably, and that's probably the thing I learned most from JP when I sit with JP, is the questions he asked me. And he asked me questions that I can't answer because I haven't spoken to the athletes about it. And really, so it came at the basis of a question, but there had to be a trust within the group between us and them and us. And we'd only just got to that point, and that was probably 6 months into the program. So trust, and I think they trust me now that I want what's best for them, not what's best for me. Or, you know, and I still see too many programs which are so coach dominated, and that can work, but for me there's not sustainability in that.
Mm.
And it feels better when they qualified and they made those decisions.
Yeah, I really appreciate a couple things in your response, Nate's question there. Is just, you're talking about the choice. Like, I think so often this is a real hot topic in sports today. What is the right balance, especially when you get to the collegiate level? There's a lot of things at play that are saying, well, you're overdoing with the athletes, or we can't do this type of conditioning. And coaches are really struggling with that. And, you know, we can't take their usual command and control. Well, this is the way it's going to be, right? But what you did was you said, hey, where do you want to go? All right, are we on that path there? Right, you have a choice. And then you got enough people on there to say, no, we want more. We want to do more. And at the same time, there's a harsh reality. You're going to lose people. You know, that there's some people are going to choose that this isn't for them. But that right there, the fact that some people choose that it's not for them says that this is special, right? If it's for everyone, then it really can't be special, right? And so you're raising the standards of USA Field Hockey, not just you, but all the players. You've empowered them to do that.
But one thing I did say that I've always been true to, you're either in and all in, or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And that had previously been very difficult because people were stepping in and out. There was a large turnover of athletes. But that was the decision that, you know, some people made and some people didn't make at that time. And being all in is the most important thing for me.
All right, that's it for part one of our conversation with Dave. Next episode, Dave will be going deeper into how he is developing a player-led culture, as well as building a support team around him for the long-term success of the program. In the meantime, I'd really encourage you to register for Dave's summer workshop series. We'll have some more details in this week's newsletter, as well as a link to learn more and register in the details of this episode. It's a great learning opportunity for you.